Yes, this has been terrific. I've really enjoyed, I was saying to Padraig just there before we start, it's been a lovely organic process. We use the kind of headlines of the materials that we have and then craft them for each day. And so I was sitting in the library from about 7:30 to make sure. And we're going to, today, I think something that we haven't done before, we're just going to walk through the text of the final two chapters and see how we make sense of them in terms of the borders and so on that we must navigate. So yes, we've looked at all sorts of borders and crossings and barriers. We'll come back to them again by the time we're finished. And we're coming closer and closer in each of these sessions to how we can begin the process of overcoming these borders that have been erected behind us. And we've stressed the importance of storytellers and artists and yesterday liturgists in that process. If you haven't been here before, this is, as I said, as Sharon has said, is our third session. In the beginning, the first one, we just looked at the first five verses of Ruth, and we looked at the process of othering, how we other people who are different, how we build stereotypes and images in our minds and perceived threats attached to those people, and how very easily and almost innocently we can walk into violence against those we have othered. Yesterday, we looked at the importance of liturgy. We looked at how the Book of Ruth functions within Jewish liturgy and began to ask ourselves questions about the role of liturgy in our lives and how liturgy shapes and forms us for our work and our being in the world. And how liturgy opens us, good liturgy and good faith practice opens us to empathy, opens us to others and to the plight of others and the position of others. And in doing that, it opens us up to the possibility of kindness. And today, as we for this final session, as we look at the last two chapters of Ruth, we're going to hit at kindness head on. We're going to tackle kindness, not niceness, as I said yesterday. That's a whole other thing, and it's an important thing. And lots of you are really, really nice. In fact, I haven't met somebody yet who isn't nice. And I've no doubt that alongside that niceness, there is also extraordinary kindness. And the challenge for us is to have faith now in the transformational impulse and power of kindness in the world. In a world which is growing rapidly more unkind. And I'm just talking about our part of the world at the moment, where the language we use of one another is growing increasingly unkind. The language we use about those who are different to us growing increasingly unkind. How historic grievances are stoked again and again by unkindness. And so today, I want us to look at kindness in this book and how it wraps it up. In each of the sessions, we've also, because I am excited by the fact that into the political ferment of the time of the writer of this book, into all the conflict and battling for supremacy to make Israel great again, a storyteller stepped and dared to believe that his story or her story had transformational power in the political furnace of their day. We have coupled these sessions with Padraig's look at poetry and the power and the insight of poetry and its the capacity of the arts to open us. Storytellers and poets and playwrights and liturgists. And this morning I want to top and tail our session with some music. I've got two songs from the same artist, and I'm delighted to say that this artist comes from my hometown, my wee hometown of Bangor in County Down. And he has two extraordinary songs story songs of kindness. I was saying a moment or two ago that I fully admit music is a taste thing, and some of you will not get this. I need to be careful that either of these songs don't undo me completely. I've known these songs for 12, 15 years, and they still, I listened to them both this morning, sitting right there, and they cause my, anyway, I'm going to play these songs, and I'm offering them to you just as an example, perhaps, or an offering, where an artist sings about a kindly act. And again, we won't spend any time looking at it, but if it connects with you, then what is connecting? What in the song, what in the lyrics or the music, what is connecting, or in the spirit of it, what is connecting and what does it stir within you? So this is a song, Padraig will know it very well, no doubt, called Gabriel and the Vagabond by Foy Vance. Does anybody know it? Good.
As my heart's close around, this whole earth is you can see his eyes as a people walk behind you. No same old words. You see they just think he's gonna take them home, go and spread them home. That man stopped by, so smile inside, as he gently whispered, the child started to cry, just kept saying, why, can't you see under? I'm 32, and I've got this one pair of shoes. If I taste them right, I think it's clear to see that even God don't love us. Why would he pay us? Then Gabriel to smile and said he pleased my child. Salvation's here today. He got up to his feet and he sang hallelujah. He blew a turn around the street. He looked there in the eyes and he sang hallelujah. There's someone here you gotta meet. Someone you just gotta meet. I'm like a bone to run with eyes. The smile disappeared. I went up to the ground, there were laughing alike, but I could not see them fall tears. When his vision came round, there was a young girl on the ground. I knew she was fine as hard. She never was a fire until he lay beside her, gently whispered. They got up to their feet and they sang hallelujah. People in the street, they were turning around. They looked them in the eyes and they sang hallelujah. There's someone here. We have found this sign. Hallelujah, 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 hallelujah. Every knee will bow, every tongue confess. I'm the voice of one crying in the wilderness, crying. Hallelujah, hallelujah. Thank you.
That song makes me want to be a better person. So we come to our story, and we come to the final two chapters, and we're going to have a fly through it. There is some aspects of these two chapters that are unusual. There are parts of them that are to do with particular culture of the time. There are parts which are to do with the particular legal structure of the time. And it's worth just saying a couple of things by way of an advance comment. This book, in fact, and these two chapters in particular are about the reformation of tradition in Israel. The startling thing in this, I keep saying it, this simple story is as profound as the transformation of the law of Moses. So this book presents to us a picture or an illustration or an example of how the law of Moses responds to an unusual situation. So it's about the reformation of tradition in Israel in favor of vulnerable people. There are three different laws, three different traditions wrapped up, woven into the narrative of the book of Ruth. The laws of inheritance, laws of redemption, and the laws of Levirate, which are to do with marriage. Here's part of the inheritance law. Now remember what's happened here. A widow has lost her husband. She's lost her husband. Very soon after that, or some years after that, she loses both her sons. So there are no male persons in the family, and we are left with three grieving widows. One who is from Israel, and two who were the hated foreigners. Now, what do you notice about this law? Let me read it out. Say to the Israelites, if a man dies and leaves no son, give his inheritance to his daughter. If he has no daughter, give his inheritance to his brothers. If he has no brothers, give his inheritance to his father's brothers. If his father had no brothers, give his inheritance to the nearest relative in the clan that he may possess it. This is to have the force of law for the Israelites as the Lord commanded Moses. What strikes you about that law? Oh, it was all the women who jumped in first thing. Yeah. Naomi has no rights. So Elimelech's land, when Elimelech dies, it passes to his sons. That's fine. But then both the sons die as well without children. So who owns their land back in Bethlehem? So distant relatives, but Naomi at the moment is in a very insecure legal position. The laws of redemption, if one of your fellow Israelites becomes poor and sells some of their property, their nearest relative is to come and redeem what they have sold. Now we'll hit that one head on. This is where if somebody is just a really poor farmer, a lazy farmer, and their land just goes to ruin and they get into debt and they have to buy their way out of debt. They buy their way out of debt by selling their land. But a relative can step in and buy that back on their behalf. Now, the near relative doesn't own the land. He holds it in trust for the lazy farmer. But again, Naomi's in a difficult position. It's not quite clear whether she has full title to the land. And at this stage in the story, we don't even know if she has any family whatsoever. And certainly she seems to have forgotten possibilities. And the last is this really strange text on marriage, Levirate marriage. If brothers are living together and one of them dies without a son, his widow must not marry outside the family. Now, not only has this family moved outside of their wider clan. They've moved outside the country, and their boys have married these foreign women. Her husband's brother shall take her and marry her and fulfill the duty of a brother-in-law to her. The first son she bears shall carry on the name of the dead brother so that his name will not be blotted out from Israel. Now, carry that with you right to the very end, okay? That little bit of text. Carry that in the back of your mind when we get. The purpose of this marriage is to secure, obviously, something, some kind of protection for the widow, but principally, it's to keep the man's name alive in the clan and in the family and in the nation. However, if a man does not want to marry, this is class. If a man does not want to marry his brother's wife, she shall go to the elders at the town gate and say, "My husband's brother refuses to carry on his brother's name in Israel. He will not fulfill the duty of a brother-in-law to me." Then the elders of his town shall summon him and talk to him. And if he persists in saying, "I don't want to marry her," his brother's widow shall go up to him in the presence of the elders, take off one of his sandals, spit in his face and say, "This is what is done to the man who will not build up his brother's family line." This is great. "This man's line shall be known in Israel as the family of the unsandaled." We know what the family of the unsandaled are like. They can't be trusted and so on. So this is a curious thing. It's designed, yes, it has some degree of protection for the widow, but principally it's designed to keep the man's name alive. So there are the three traditions that are at play in these final two chapters. The thing is, none of them apply neatly to any of our characters. This can't apply to Naomi because the implication in the text is she's beyond the stage of having children. And therefore, there's no point in her entering into one of these marriages because they can't have children. And therefore, there's no way to carry on the name of her husband. And it's quite clear from the very first sentence that it doesn't apply to Ruth because she is outside the family. She's a foreigner. So this doesn't apply to Ruth. So these laws in force are very unclear for Naomi's situation. A bit clearer for Ruth, but they're wrapped up into the narrative of what comes. So let's get quickly then into the story. We're going to scoot through it and comment as we go through. And actually, I'm going to read it. We don't often read big chunks of the scriptural story, but I think in this case it's worth it. So chapter 3. One day, Ruth's mother-in-law, Naomi, said to her, "My daughter, I must find a home for you where you will be well provided for." Naomi has been, we said earlier, paralyzed by grief and almost completely silent and helpless. In the beginning of chapter 2, remember, the first chapter ends with the beginning, with the harvest just beginning. Chapter 2 begins, Naomi is silent, grieving. And Ruth steps up to the plate to take responsibility to feed the family. And she exploits the gleaning laws in a way that, again, is open to question because those laws don't apply to her as a foreigner. But she takes responsibility. But by the end of that harvest, nothing has happened. Nothing has been resolved. This guy, Boaz, who promised, a kind of held out some kind of hope, has not stepped up to his responsibilities. Wouldn't be the first time a man has promised a woman something and then not carried through. But Naomi has somehow recovered some kind of agency here. And she says, we've got to do something. We need to take care of you. Now, Boaz, with whose women you have worked, is a relative of ours. Tonight, he will be winnowing barley on the threshing floor. Story, as you can see, is very concerned to tell us about the threshing floor. Come back to that in a minute. Naomi says to Ruth, verse 3, wash, put on perfume, and get dressed in your best clothes. Then go down to the threshing floor. It's almost like the threshing floor is a pickup joint. Wash, put on your best makeup, your best clothes, you know, doll yourself up and go down to the threshing floor. I think what it's hinting at is quite clear. I don't think it's even a hint. But I'm not Nadia Boltz-Weber, so I'm going to be a little bit more restrained. So, go down to the threshing floor, but don't let him know you are there until he has finished eating and drinking. When he lies down, note the place where he is lying, then go and uncover his feet and lie down. He will tell you what to do. I will do whatever you say, Ruth answered. So she went down to the threshing floor and did everything her mother-in-law told her to do. Let me fill you in a little bit of detail about the threshing room floor. At the end of the harvest, when the last of the harvest has been brought in and has been threshed, says the expert farmer, and everything has done, the men who have been employed in the harvest throw a party. And when he has finished eating and drinking and lies down, they eat and they drink to excess on the threshing room floor. But it's also the place where vulnerable women come and sell their bodies to the men who are having a party at the end of the harvest. Now, you might call them prostitutes, or you might call them women who have very little choice or very few options to survive. And they go down to the threshing room floor, and there is a party, and they know they can earn a little bit of money with the men who've had too much to eat and too much to drink. Ruth, it seems to me, joins this gathering. Hence, bathing, perfume, and her best clothes. So when Boaz had finished eating and drinking and was in good spirits. This is the Bible text. This is not my translation of it. This is the text. He went over to lie down at the far end of the grain pile. So he's in no fit state to go home. So he goes and he lies down at the grain pile. Ruth approached him quietly, uncovered his feet, and lay down. In the middle of the night, something startled the man. He turned, and there was a woman lying at his feet. And I'm sure it was, "Who are you?" I suspect it was more of a drunken, startled panic. "Who the hell are you? What?" Just because this man is still drunk. "I'm your servant Ruth," she said. "Spread the corner of your garment over me, since you are a guardian redeemer of our family." A couple of things here. Boaz is drunk, and he lies down to sleep off the drink. This woman comes and uncovers his feet. Some people say she uncovered his feet, and it was the fact that his feet got cold in the middle of the night that woke him up out of his drunken stupor. And he had this conversation with Ruth. However, some of the rabbis would suggest that uncover his feet is a euphemism for uncover his penis. Now I am sounding like Nadia. For uncover his penis. and therefore is a euphemism for sex. So she comes into the threshing room floor after spying where this particular man lies down, and she goes over and she wakes this drunken man, and she has sex with this drunken man, who when he wakes up can't even remember if they did the deed. Who are you? What's happened? Did we? You remember what Naomi said to Ruth? Uncover his feet, and then he will tell you what to do. What happens here? She doesn't give him a moment. She takes complete command of the situation and instructs him in what you should do. And do you know why? I think this here, if you have a Bible text in front of you and you were to turn back to chapter 2, verse 12, Boaz, in his early, one of his, maybe his first encounter with Ruth, praises her for her goodness and her kindness to Naomi, his relative. And he prays for her and he says, may God cover you with his wings like a cloak. She's heard his prayer for her. And now she says, you answer it. If you're praying that for me, don't push responsibility off onto some distant deity when you have the power to make good this situation. You do it. You become God to me and spread the corner of your garment over me. Since you are a guardian redeemer of our family. Hold on a second, Ruth. You're a Moabite. Now, you may have married a member of our family, but he's gone. We have no ties to you. How dare you describe yourself as a member of our family? That's the easy answer. So sex has happened. And then she takes responsibility and says, you can't use me like this because we're part of the family. And she dares him to challenge that. The Lord bless you, my daughter, he replied. This kindness, there's that word again we saw right back in the first chapter, chesed, the word that is most often referred to the actions and the character of God and is now once again being attributed to this foreign woman. This kindness is greater than that which you showed earlier. You've not run after the younger men, whether rich or poor. And now, my daughter, don't be afraid. I will do for you all that you ask. Finally, he should have done it at the end of chapter 2, and he didn't. And they've had to resort to desperate measures to get this guy to live up to his responsibilities. This woman has had to sell her body to persuade this man to do what he has to do. All the people of my town know that you are a woman of noble character. Although it is true that I am a guardian redeemer of our family, there is another more closely related than I. Stay here for the night. That coupled with the final sentence, lie here until morning, suggests to me that the sex wasn't a one-off thing. Because actually, all the business between them has been resolved at this point. I will do what I have to do first thing in the morning. When the town wakes, I will go and do it. Now listen, best for you to go home under cover of darkness. Instead, he says, stay here. Because, and I think this is our hint that he has accepted Ruth's argument that you foreigner, you foreign woman, you are now our family. And he promises. So she lay at his feet until morning, but got up before anyone could be recognized. And he said, no one must know that a woman came to the threshing floor. Now, everybody knew women came to the threshing room floor. But I think what he's saying here is, nobody must know that you came to the threshing room floor. because you're family. And I am going to do what I should have done earlier, before you had to resort to these desperate measures. So we've got to get you away from here. He said, bring me the shawl you are wearing and hold it out. And when she did so, he poured into it 6 measures of barley and placed the bundle on her, and she went back into town. I think 2 things are happening here. One is literary and one is a cool deception. I think what Boaz is doing here, because it's just getting light, so she's not recognized as she walks away, he alters her body shape with a load of grain and sends her away with a load of grain wrapped up in her coat. So if somebody did spy her in the half light, they wouldn't recognize Ruth. The other thing I like to imagine, and I don't know if it's true, but for me, I like to imagine that he folded it up, or she folded it up in her cloak like this. And so she was sent away carrying a load in the front. Isn't that just gorgeous? Because here is either one of 2 things. In a literary sense, here is a promise that her future will be secured, that there will be a pregnancy. And or, here is a literary hint that she is already pregnant from the night's activity and that her world is beginning to change. And she goes back to town. When Ruth came to her mother-in-law, Naomi asked, well, how'd it go? How many of you are mothers in the room and have asked your daughters after a night out on the town, well, how did it go, my daughter? Then she told her everything Boaz had done for her, I bet, and added, he gave me these 6 measures of barley, saying, don't go back to your mother-in-law empty-handed. No, he didn't. But again, here is something of Ruth's close concern for Naomi. He wasn't thinking of Naomi at that time. He was thinking of making sure that Ruth's reputation wasn't sullied by being recognized as she scurried away from the threshing room floor. But again, just this lovely kindness of Ruth towards her mother-in-law. He was thinking of you. Naomi said, wait, my daughter, until you find out what happens, for the man will not rest until the matter is settled today. This is the dramatic heart of the story, this chapter, chapter 3. Because before we turn over into chapter 4, we're left wondering, well, he didn't do it in chapter 2. Will he do it now? Will he carry through on his promises? And we know from the story that not just Boaz, but all of the people there in the town, they recognize that this foreigner is a woman of noble character. The real question, though, is, can she be redeemed as a member of the family? Will he be able to pull her into the family? Would he dare hook himself to this foreigner as if she was a member of his family? Could he bear the potential scandal of being married to a Moabite, with all we know that that entails? So chapter 4 opens. While she's talking to Naomi, meanwhile, Boaz went up to the town gate and sat down there just as the guardian redeemer, that's the closer relative he had mentioned, came along. Boaz said, come over here, my friend, and sit down. So he went over and sat down. Boaz took 10 elders of the town and said, sit here, and they did so. Then he said to the guardian redeemer, Naomi, who has come back from Moab, is selling the piece of land that belonged to our relative Elimelech. I thought I should bring the matter to your attention and suggest that you, by it in the presence of these seated here and in the presence of the elders of my people. If you will do redeem it, do so. But if you will not tell me so, I will know, for no one has the right to do it except you, and I'm next in line. So, this closer relative strokes his chin. And the good farmer that he is, he calculates all the numbers in his head. And he thinks, a bit of extra land, that would be good. There's no likelihood of Naomi having a son. So, you know, it's win-win here. The land will eventually come to me. Of course I'll do it. I will do it. I will redeem it, he said. Then clever Boaz has kind of reeled him in. Oh, yeah, a little bit of extra land. And Boaz said, one other thing I forgot to say. On the day you buy the land from Naomi, you also acquire, interesting word, but you also acquire Ruth the Moabite. The dead man's widow. In order to maintain the name of the dead with his property. Now, this guy wasn't banking on this. And at this, the guardian redeemer said, ooh, then I can't redeem it. Because I might endanger my own estate. You redeem it yourself. I can't do it. Now, in earlier times, and here's this reference to how this law has developed. In earlier times in Israel, for the redemption and transfer of property to become final, one party took off a sandal and gave it to the other. This was the method of legalizing transactions in Israel. It's the writer giving us a little bit of necessary detail. So the guardian redeemer said to Boaz, buy it yourself, and he removed his sandal. Now, this is, I think, it's easy to be critical of this nearer relative, but land and transfer of land between families is a complex thing. And if you're farming families, you know. When that land lies at or around borders, it becomes even more difficult. Or when that land is in some way part of a contested land, it becomes difficult. Back home in Ireland, farms owned by one side or the other, by Protestant or Catholic, when you're selling the farm, you like to make sure it goes to one of our sort. You don't want it to go to the others. And so people hold on to land way past their energies and to the detriment of the land itself, rather than sell it to the foreigner, because the other means we are conceding some ground, we are losing. And in the bigger scale of the conflict, that's another piece of land lost to the hated enemy. And so land in Ireland, as I'm sure it's here, and the transfer of land is a highly political thing. In this case, he was comfortable to do it with Naomi because he knew there was no possibility of a child with Naomi, and therefore the land would remain within his estate, be more for his children, would reflect better on him down the line because he was a wealthy man, grew his estate and passed it on, etc. Looks good. But as soon as Ruth is added in, he becomes worried. She can have children. Not only that, any children I have with this woman will not be Jewish children. They will not be part of the tribe because they were born of a foreign woman. There's a possibility here that the land will pass out of, not just out of the clan, but out of our people to foreigners. We can't have that. And so he refuses to do it because of the risk to his estate and also to the at the risk to national identity, giving over land to these foreigners who are coming in here and taking over our jobs and our land and everything else. So no, I'm not doing that. Interestingly enough, and this is the hint of where the story's going, or or what Ruth has already achieved. He doesn't say, I don't need to marry her, she's a foreigner. Because that's the easy thing. I'm taking the land, but I'm not marrying her. I don't have to marry her, she's a foreigner. But even this guy, who is resistant to the idea of marrying her because of the threat to his estate, has already begun to think of Ruth as one of ours. This foreigner has somehow become part of us. She's still not family, but she's accepted. And this is why I think Boaz cleverly does all this in the open, in public, makes no secret of the fact, reminds them all, Ruth, the Moabite. So that everybody, the elders of the town, the gathered women who are watching on, everybody sees this is happening. He's doing this properly, legally, in full view, because he knows that if he's going to marry her as family, it's another step to be accepted into the community as family. So everybody needs to be behind this marriage. So he does it in public. So Boaz announced to the elders and all the people, today you are witnesses that I have bought from Naomi all the property of Elimelech, Chilion, and Mahlon, they're the two sons. I have also acquired Ruth the Moabite, Mahlon's widow, as my wife, in order to maintain the name of the dead with his property. Again, carry that in the back of your head. So that his name will not disappear from among his family or from his hometown. Today, you are witnesses. He pulls everybody into this change. The law does not apply to Ruth because of her foreignness. Boaz is daring the community to say, we need to cross this barrier. This woman is part of this community. In fact, she's one of us. And he raises the possibility that belonging can come in a range of different ways, not just ethnically, not just religiously. There's a sense in which Ruth proves her belonging by her character. Just to wrap up the story, before we begin to sum some things up and have a conversation about this. Then the elders and all the people at the gate said, we agree. We are witnesses. May the Lord make the woman who was coming into your home like Rachel and Leah, who together built up the family of Israel. Oh, how about that for a welcome to foreigners? Make her like two of our matriarchs who built up the family, who built up the nation. May you have standing in Ephrathah and be famous in Bethlehem through the offspring the Lord gives you by this young woman. May your family be like Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah. Again, the folding in of a child born through an illicit relationship. And if you want to be thoroughly scandalized, go back later and read the story of Tamar and Judah, her father-in-law. So Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife. When he made love to her, the Lord enabled her to conceive, and she gave birth to a son. The women said to Naomi, praise be to the Lord, who this day has not left you without a guardian redeemer. May he become famous throughout Israel. He will renew your life. Ah, the grieving widow. This is gorgeous. He will renew you in your old age. I saw that in my own father-in-law, who had almost given up. And then another grandson arrived, and it renewed his life. He will renew your life and sustain you in your old age. For your daughter-in-law, no mention Ruth the Moabite. No mention. Earlier, one of the passages I love, Boaz says to his manager, because I think he already fancies her very early on in chapter 2. He says, who's that woman over there? And the manager says, oh, that's Ruth, the Moabite from Moab. They just couldn't, in these early days, get over the fact that Moabites are living here. Ruth, the Moabite from Moab. But here, it's gone. She is your daughter-in-law. She is family. For your daughter-in-law, who loves you and is better to you than seven sons, has given him birth. Then Naomi took her child in her arms and cared for him. Hold on a minute. Whose child? Exactly. They took the baby from Ruth and handed the baby to Naomi. The women living there said, Naomi has a son. Naomi has a son. Ruth at this stage has completely disappeared. Ruth, and there's a whole other conversation to be had in relation to this. Ruth has the baby boy and disappears from the story completely. The women living there, Naomi has a son and they named him Obed. He was the father of Jesse, the father of David. This then is the family line of Perez. Perez was the father of Hezron, Hezron the father of Ram, Ram the father of Amminadab, Amminadab the father of Nashon, Nashon the father of Salmon, Salmon the father of Boaz, Boaz the father of Obed, Obed the father of Jesse, and Jesse the father of David. What's wrong with the list? Sorry? Who is missing from the list? You know, it's all the men. This is the usual way with these things. Whose name are we not supposed to forget? Naomi's son, Ruth's husband, her first husband. Boaz said, yes. He says, I need to marry this woman so that the name of Naomi's son, Mahlon, does not disappear out of Israel. You know, want to see it? Where is it? Back here. Verse 10. I have acquired Ruth the Moabite, Mahlon's widow, as my wife in order to maintain the name of the dead with his property. He's gone. He's gone. So, and it's an interesting thing to reflect on, but in some ways, so thoroughly was Ruth folded into the family. And so comprehensively did Boaz change the way people thought about belonging that the old story disappears and there's a new story now. The new story that wraps up into itself this incident between Boaz and Ruth. Ruth doesn't have to change, doesn't have to become, as we often do when we're trying to be inclusive, Ruth doesn't have to become more Bethlehemite than the Bethlehemites. She doesn't have to prove herself to be a hyper-Israelite. And if you've ever made a transition like this, if you've ever made a change from one place to another, or from one nation to another, or one denomination to another, and you felt the pressure to be more than those who've been all the time, to prove yourself worthy of this new place, Ruth doesn't have to do that. So thoroughly she folded in. She's folded in as the other. She is accepted for who she is. Ruth, the Moabite from Moab, is now one of us. She is redeemed as the other. And this Jewish writer, Ruth enables the opening of the patriarchal masculine with the troubling foreign feminine presence. What What the narrative has done, what this story has done, is that it connects these three laws that we were looking at that apply in very conflicted ways, and there's no clear route through to protect these vulnerable women. But the narrative connects these three laws of inheritance, redemption, and marriage, so that one widow, Naomi, holds title. So they clear up the title issue. A redeemer, Boaz, redeems the land, even though he technically didn't have to. The land could have just passed, but it would have passed to the closer relative. And he marries the widow, the foreign widow of childbearing age. So all these laws are adjusted and clarified in the light of the circumstances in Bethlehem at the time. I want to suggest to you all of this, out of all of this reading, this is where this book of Ruth, I think, comes home to a real sharp point. Where the application of law results in an unforeseen or an unintended, unkind consequence for vulnerable people, the law must be changed. Now, what we're dealing with here is the law of Moses. This is the law delivered at Sinai. We talked about that yesterday. This is the law delivered with all the pomp and circumstance of the shaking mountain, delivered by the world changers. Boaz, in the face of the overwhelming evidence presented by this woman, this heroic woman, Boaz says, you know, the strict application of the law means that neither Naomi nor this foreigner among us is protected by the law. Here is its shelter. We exist underneath it because we were born here and because we are Israelites or Bethlehemites. Naomi has unfortunately found herself outside of it, but there are one or two things we can do for her. We can allow her to glean, and there's enough there to protect her. But this woman that we're all hugely impressed by, she is completely outside the cover of the law. Boaz, you know, this is a sacred law. This is the law of God, the law Moses delivered. I'm really sorry, Ruth, but this is enshrined in the Constitution. Instead, Boaz says, yeah, I know it's Moses' law. I know it was delivered like this from Sinai, and here's how we've interpreted it as we've gone. But you know what? I believe that the heart of God never intended for the unkindness that has resulted for a person like Ruth. Therefore, we will extend the protection of the law to wrap the foreigner in. We will actually bring her into the family because she has demonstrated. Do you remember what we read yesterday? The language attributed to her, where she acts, they describe her in terms that they use to describe Abraham. Remember in the first day, on the first chapter, the language used to describe her is the same language used to describe the kindness of God. This foreigner has displayed all the characteristics of the goodness and kindness and love of the God we worship. Are you seriously thinking that we shouldn't extend the law of God to include her? It was said, I've been trying to remember where it was said very early on this week by somebody else. I think it might have been Nadia in her session in the center. That where rules crash up against people, people should always win. Whether that's the rules of our denominational practice, whether that's the rules of our nation, where the rules clash against people, people win. And that's where we want to suggest that the book of Ruth is the proper lens to be reading the law. This is how belonging comes about, through kindness. Not just ethnic, not just political affiliation. We're nearing the end. In this book of just four chapters, what borders have we crossed? What borders have we crossed? Okay, what borders have we crossed? Anybody want to?
Tradition.
Borders of tradition. Okay, preach that one to me. What are you saying in relation to that? What happens to tradition? How do we cross tradition? What might that mean for us?
I was wondering all through this conversation if Boaz ever had more than one wife. Do we know?
From the story, it appears he was not married. He was a landholder, but it's not.
The verses where they said that he had women, I wondered what that meant.
Mm-hmm. Regardless of the answer to that, it is his relationship with Ruth, which is the untraditional one, which changes the law. The law of the land is adjusted when he encounters this extraordinary woman. Any other borders crossed? I think borders of tradition.
Oh, yeah. About tradition. First of all, Elimelech and all of them crossed the border.
Yeah.
To get into Moab.
Yeah.
The boys crossed borders by marrying Moab women.
Yes. Yes.
Who can't be trusted.
Can't be trusted. Who cannot be trusted. And you know, it says in the Torah, and this is my paraphrase of it, for Edom, you may include them after four generations. Even for Egypt, you can include them after four generations. But for Moab, never. Never. So they've crossed this border. Yeah.
I think the miracle for me in this whole story is that in Matthew 1, the only name given of a woman is whose wife was Ruth. Boaz, whose wife was Ruth. Yeah. And here it goes completely against the law that never would a Moabite be included. And yet, she's here in the genealogy of Jesus.
It's amazing, isn't it?
It's an amazing story. Yeah.
Actually, and that chapter is really, really interesting. And it's a whole other conversation. But there are, I think there are five women. If you count Mary, the mother of Jesus, there are five women in
but
that story.
She is listed in the genealogy.
And she's, but there are five women listed, named, all of them with dubious sexual histories.
Right.
All of them. Deal with that. All of them have dubious sexual histories, and yet they are included. And one is not even named. She's referred to. The woman who was raped.
Tamar.
No, Bathsheba. Bathsheba. She's not even named, but she's included. But yeah. It is an extraordinary thing. This woman who will never be included is in tradition in the family line of Jesus. Yeah. Any other lines we've crossed, Anne?
The other border is Ruth herself. She did not need to stay with Naomi. She could have stayed in her own quite well.
Yeah.
So she crossed the border.
I would love to. I would love to write an addendum to this story in which Ruth and Orpah write letters back and forth to one another. What happened to Orpah?
We're doing that later on.
There you go. There you go. That's there you go tonight in Padraig's session. What happens to both of them? What does Ruth say about this experience she has of new belonging, new inclusion?
I don't know if it's a border that's been crossed, but Boaz, he's reminding the people that there are more laws than just these three. Because over and over in the law, it says, do not oppress the resident alien. Do not oppress the resident alien. And he's saying, hey, you know, there's more to this law than just these three things that allow us to steal land and do what we want.
Yeah. Yes, we looked at that verse yesterday, for those of you who aren't here. Do not oppress a resident alien, for you know the heart of an alien, for you were an alien in Egypt. And that's where, you know, the importance of this empathy comes. This how do we develop the attention, the memory that constantly recalls to us and nurtures in us that empathy for those who are foreigners amongst us, who are different. Because where we are encountering people who are on the outside, the impulse of that text is, bring them in. Bring them in. And if your tradition needs to change, if your laws need to change, change them to bring them in. So behind you, come to your second, Ginger.
Was the hatred of the Israelites for Moab's return? In other words, did the Moab's despise the Israelites as much? Because I'm wondering if Ruth and Orpah could even have been accepted back once they had Israel.
Yeah, absolutely.
Maybe they couldn't find a Moab man who would accept someone who was so soiled at that point.
Yeah, and I think that's why you should go to the workshop tonight and pick up that exact stream, because all I gave you was the Israelite view of Moab. You can't trust their women. Because Moses came back and found, the poor Israelite men being led astray sexually by these sexually voracious Moabite women. What stories told in Moab about Israelite men? And what they did? Yeah, yeah. You know, lock the gates of the village because the Israelite men are coming. So there undoubtedly there'll be stories. And of course, we do know that they didn't. We do know at least when, as I said on day one, that when the king took advice about whether the king of Moab took advice about whether or not he should provide food and water to the Israelites in the desert, he talked to his advisors, and his advisors say, don't do it under no circumstances, because literally those Israelites will hoover up everything. So, you know, you can begin to see that this antipathy runs both ways. There are stereotypes that run both ways here, and at least Bethlehem, at least, found a way of adjusting the law to include this woman. Any other traditions crossed? Any other borders crossed? Ginger, yes, sorry.
It's like they also cross the laws of human nature. So for us in America today, it's the prosperity gospel. And so it's so easy to say bad things happen to bad people. And look what he did. He left during the famine to take care of himself. He married more. So, I mean, those bad things, you know, God's punishing them, or they deserve that, you know. And so really, I mean, just this change in the law was a huge overcoming, you know, human nature has been the same all these years, you know, to overcome that.
And that kind of human instinct of protectionism and prejudice, and there's incredible generosity and kindness in this act, and a recognition people matter. Let me give you your Hebrew lesson for the day. The Hebrew word Shekinah is the word, you've heard of it, It means the kind of glory, majesty, the weight of God. It's that, the impenetrable glory of God, the shining majesty of God. Without going into technicalities about it, Hebrew is mainly consonantal language. So the consonants of the word Shekinah are S-K-N. S-K-N are also the main consonants of the Hebrew word for neighbor. So the root of the word for the majesty and glory of God is the exact same root of the Hebrew word for neighbor. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. Love your neighbor as yourself. Because actually, the glory of God is seen in love for a neighbor, and the way this kindness and love can transform the world. Love God, love your neighbor are two sides of the same thing. A couple of quick things. Oh, we're way over time, are we? Oh, no, we're not. We've got a bit of time. A couple of quick things. To just four very simple things to reflect back over the three chapters. Firstly, when we, or the four chapters, when we looked at chapter one and that concentration on Moab and the prejudice that existed and the racism almost that existed against the Moabites, and the terrible things that are said about people who are different in any form of conflict. We recognize it very clearly in the Brexit debate, where both sides in Brexit are flinging horrendous language back and forth against one another. We notice it in the conflict in Northern Ireland, where our own borders of tradition and ethnicity and religion and nationalisms clash against one another. We have said and continue to say terrible things against one another and over those borders that exist. We need to remember that one day, if peace is going to come, we are going to have to walk back from the terrible things we've said about one another. And however deep the differences may be with the others, we need to mind our language, how we speak about those who are different. Because in any process of repair and reconciliation, that language is going to have to be dealt with one day. Can we find better language of one another, better words for one another, that don't ignore the differences, that don't ignore the conflict, but that won't have to be walked back from sometime in the future? It took a lot for the Bethlehemites to overcome the language they had used against the Moabites for generations. It's taken a lot, you know, the relationships between England, particularly, and Ireland, whilst not perfect, have improved immensely over the years of the common cause made in trying to build a peace in Northern Ireland. And Brexit threatens to undermine the stuff. But it's taken a long time, and it's taken a lot of hard work and honest conversation to overcome the language barriers that we've created. So that even in the World Cup just passed, and the England team was going so well, and the Irish team didn't even make it to the finals, the number of friends and family back home who had a sneaking regard, making increasingly public, of support for the England football team was extraordinary. I've never seen it in my life. I'm not there yet, but I hope to one day. Remember, we're going to have to walk back from the language and the things we've said about one another. Secondly, I think we have got to open ourselves to understanding to those who are different. It's so easy in the current... Back home, there is a Brexit press and there's a Remain press. And you consume the media that simply bolsters what you already believe. We need to find it in ourselves as a route towards understanding those and to developing empathy for those who are different and other, to consuming other news sources to help us understand, to open ourselves at least to a different and a new understanding and a new sympathy or empathy towards those who are different. Practice attention. We can practice attention. Do you remember that that three-line Mary Oliver poem yesterday? Pay attention. Be astonished. Tell about it. Pay attention. Be astonished. Tell about it. Tell about it. Speak about it. Witness to it. We can learn to pay attention. We can develop empathy through attention. Liturgy helps us do that. Those of you who have been part of the poetry readings and the work we've done in the workshops Padraig has led can see yesterday in particular how the words of the poet can open doors in us as the poem reads us. Practice attention. Act with kindness. Believe in the transformational power of kindness. Believe that kindness is a major political tool in our current divisions. Believe that we will find a voice for kindness, that kindness will find its voice amidst the clamor of all the other political divisions and shouting that's going on there, that real kindness, particularly kindness directed to those who are other, has a transformational power. Anything else that you want to share with the group?
I think we need to add to remember that God calls everyone beloved.
Say that out loud again.
To remember that God calls everyone beloved.
Okay, everybody hear that? Thanks, Kim. Even the Moabites in our midst. Any other takeaways before I play you a final song? And incarnate it, embody it, do it. I'm impressed by what appeared to be in this story a small private action between it within one family that was done ultimately visibly. Obviously, Ruth had a visible presence in that community too. But Boaz gave a platform to that. Finally, eventually, he gave a platform to it. And it resulted in a transformation of their law. How do we give a platform to what is best about ourselves? How can we do that? Because the temptation is that we use the tools to advance our cause that we've seen being successful on the other side. We are already thinking about this and the other side. Church was never meant to be on one side. So how do we do this without resorting to the tactics of those who are advancing causes in other ways? That's a challenge. It's a challenge to us.
I think we can claim what we've done, and there's really good liturgy written about in confession and forgiveness of the things that we've done to continue this separation, the walls that are built between people. There's some really great resources, and not to speak against the bishop, but there is a really lovely immigrant's creed that has been written that my church found very helpful to me during Advent.
And these resources are available,
I presume?
Online.
Yeah.
Good.
Or talk to me, I can
send
you my
liturgy. Good. Kim's in the corner. But we'll come out of the corner and we'll be here if you want to get access to some of those resources. Let me play a song. This is by the same artist, as I said, from my hometown. And this is... this is a song called Indiscriminate Act of Kindness.
She came in from the cold, dropped her luggage bags at the concierge in the eye. Said I need a room for the night, but I don't got no money. Would you take baby kindly? He said, it's all right, I'll be sharing. Make the bed in the morning, and I'll do fine. You can change in the bathroom, have your clothes on the line. Until you came to light, you thought, how could he be so high? Sat down on the bed by the knee, and he said, I need to see you bleed. Just fetch a warm towel and sit with you till you're dry. She started to cry, said, why? Consider it an indiscriminate act of kindness. Consider it an indiscriminate act of kindness. Consider it an indiscriminate act of kindness. She was cold turkey, he was holding her heart. She said, I was ruined by mine. This was never in my heart. Treat no man who loved me. Together we'd see the world. Somehow I lost myself among the insults they heard. I'm sure you're a wonderful one, and someday there will surely be someone. So just relax, it's important that you come. She said, how is it you can see past me as I am? Consider it an indiscriminate act of kindness. Consider it an indiscriminate act of kindness. Consider it an indiscriminate act of kindness. Took your chances, was like you placed the bet. And sometimes this is the reward you can get. And I was always told, if you see someone deep down, you should look them in the eye and smile. And take their heart, no medicine, take them home. Home.
saw the concierge girl on the settee and said what you did for me. It's hard for me to believe. I was just doing what was right. No one that knows love could lead I down such a night. If you could help someone bear this in mind and consider it early indiscriminate act of kindness. 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 Consider it.
Thank you for your faithful attendance over the three sessions, and also over Padraig's sessions in the evening. It's been something of a risk, I guess, for us in that this material has been developed for a particular purpose back home, and we had a sense that it might have some relevance here too. This resource, which is the full resource of the Ruth material, is available for download from the Coromila website there free, gratis, and for nothing. And we'd be delighted if you could make use of it. And also, if you do, personally or in groups or in your communities, drop us an email to let us know what you learned or what was useful and what wasn't. Our plan is that next year we'll take this material and redraft it for more to make it more generally applicable. So we remove the Brexit elements of it. But I think with a little bit of work, you could ignore that even now and work with the story. Also, if you are interested in issues of conflict transformation, and handling conflict, we have an online resource at spiritualityofconflict.com. which takes the gospel text in the lectionary and writes thought material, sermon material, prayers, activities, actions arising out of the text for each Sunday's gospel text. We're currently in year B. And again, it's available all on the website there for those preachers among you, or for if you're interested in just personal reflection or Bible study. Spirituality of Conflict, we'll find more of this kind of material. And then lastly, we'd like you to stay in touch. Coromila is the community we are part of, Ireland's oldest peace and reconciliation community and organization. I can see, I've no doubt that you are all avid Twitter readers. And for those of you that are, you'll find us at Coromila. Padraig is on at Duanala, and I'm on Crooked Shore, if that's of any use, and that might open up some other conversations and resources and so on. We'd be delighted. Padraig, do you want to say something about tonight's workshop? Okay. 6 o'clock?
Yeah.
And it will take a different, it'll approach the Ruth text from a different trajectory, if you're interested in doing some more. But thank you.
Thank you.